Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith. We look at state congressional races, then discuss U.S. foreign policy and the elections. If you're following U.S. elections on FM 91.7 WHUS stores, you'll want to join us Tuesday, election night, between 7 p.m. and midnight for Democracy Now!'s election night coverage, whus.org to listen live. Pollsters at Rasmussen give Democrats a 98.3 chance of winning in this Democratic stronghold. They put Barack Obama ahead of Republican John McCain by 17 points. The Hartford Courant newspaper finds Obama leading by 25 points, and a recent University of Connecticut poll found students favoring Obama by a 3-to-1 margin. But will heavy support for Barack Obama translate into victory in state congressional races for Democrats? The answer could depend on who voters blame for the economic crisis, the failure of U.S. banks, and the biggest decline on Wall Street in 60 years. Connecticut has previously ranked at the top in per capita income, but a 2008 report showed the state slipping to number 3 behind Delaware and Alaska in per capita income and ranking below New York on annual income. 19% of the state's children now live in low-income working families. Brandon Roberts of the Working Poor Families Project is hoping the candidates running for office this year will study their latest report showing sharp increases in working poor.
Our report looks at the condition of low-income working families across the country, comparing the status in 2002 to 2006. 2006 is the last year that census data is available. And unfortunately, we find that during times of good economic growth, some might even say robust economic growth, the number of low-income working families in the United States increased by 350,000. When we look at Connecticut and we look at 2006, we see that still in Connecticut, despite this good economic times, almost 70,000 working families are still low income in Connecticut, which doesn't represent any type of significant change from 2002. So once again, the economic conditions are not benefiting these families. And when you look at these almost 70,000 families, you find that 140,000 children reside in those families. So we're talking about a large number of children in Connecticut that reside, almost one out of five children in working families reside in these low-income families.
What are some of the factors contributing to this stagnation for working families in terms of income?
One of the issues that our report highlights is the situation in the job market. Our data in 2006 found that 22% of all jobs are in occupations paying below poverty. And this was an increase from 2002 nationwide of approximately 4.7 million jobs. So one, we're producing jobs that don't pay wages that support a family. And two, as we look more deeply into that data, we see that almost half of the 4.7 million are jobs that aren't keeping pace with the cost of living. So they have fallen back where in 2002, they were above poverty wage. Now in 2006, they are below. As we look at various factors, a very high percentage of low-income working families in Connecticut pay more than one-third of their income to housing, a feature that places Connecticut toward the bottom of all states. And then also you can see in Connecticut, according to our data, that the income inequality between working families at the top of the ladder versus those at the bottom, Connecticut has one of the most serious income inequality ratios of any state in the country.
Brandon Roberts is with the Working Poor Families Project. Brandon Roberts, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me and focusing on this issue.
A July poll by Quinnipiac University found voters extremely worried about rising fuel prices. Next in line was concern over the cost of food and health care, then concern about not having enough retirement funds. And voters here do tie Iraq war spending to the economic crisis. These and other concerns have put Republican Christopher Shays at risk of losing his 4th district seat after 11 terms. The 4th District includes wealthy voters in suburban Greenwich and working class and poor voters in cities like Bridgeport and Stamford. In fact, some of the nation's most poor can be found living in proximity with billionaire hedge fund managers. Democratic challenger Jim Himes has been targeting working class voters. He has the support of major Connecticut unions, and he's now running neck and neck with Chris Shays, who has run into problems over his support for the Bush administration's plan for private accounts for Social Security.
And we're not going to privatize Social Security until Americans agree that some of it should be.
Polls taken during the 2006 congressional race in Connecticut indicated a deep mistrust for the Bush administration's private accounts plan and that voters here will never support privatization for Social Security. On his webpage, Democratic challenger Jim Himes says he's against the private accounts plan and that by taking even one-third of Social Security funding to create private savings accounts, Chris Shays' plan would signal the start of a Republican privatization strategy.
My opponent, Chris Shays, has spent a 21-year career in Congress promoting the privatization of Social Security, co-sponsoring bills in 1997 and 1998 that would have privatized Social Security as recently as July of this year, saying that the privatization of Social Security is a very good idea.
Jim Himes joined another Connecticut Democrat, State Representative Rosa DeLauro of the 3rd Congressional District, in calling attention to his opposition to privatizing Social Security.
Now, because we are going into an election, he is muddying the waters about where he is on this. But for the last 21 years, he has been a proponent of the privatization of Social Security. Ladies and gentlemen, the stock market has lost $8 trillion in wealth. Seniors with private accounts opening up their account statements this month would have seen tens of thousands of dollars in losses. People expecting to retire in the next couple of years would have been, were their private accounts, pushing off that retirement for years into the future.
Christopher Shays won Connecticut's 4th District by a mere 3 points in 2006. Challenger Diane Farrell won over voters who were against the Iraq War. Here's Chris Shays defending U.S. policy in Iraq on the floor of Congress.
What we do have is a new plan, and it's not the surge, it's cleaning up the neighborhoods and holding them with Iraqi troops embedded with American troops.
In Iraq itself, however, growing concern over new indications that the U.S. military will widen the scope of the strategy Shays describes as, quote, clearing neighborhoods. Defense Secretary Robert M. Gates issued a clarification of Bush administration policy to, quote, hold any state, terrorist group or other non-state actor or individual fully accountable for supporting or enabling terrorist efforts to obtain or use weapons of mass destruction, whether by facilitating, financing, or providing expertise or safe haven for such efforts. Writing in the New York Times Tuesday, October 28th, Tom Shanker called Gates' remarks the Bush administration's most expansive description yet of a vision of deterrence for the post-September 11 world. Iraqi government spokesperson Ali al-Dabakh said his country is currently investigating a raid by 4 U.S. helicopters that killed 8 people in Syria. Amid Iraqi government requests for changes to a proposed security pact with the U.S. that would keep U.S. military in Iraq for at least 3 more years, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has called for a U.S. pledge not to use Iraq as a, quote, center for aggression in the Mideast. The U.S. military has meanwhile added another complex problem to the mix. America is now training Iraqis to fly U.S. aircraft, according to CNN's Kira Phillips, that in addition to using unmanned drones to target Pakistan. We're joined by 2 journalists now who both see the potential for an escalation of the Iraq war, even as George W. Bush and Dick Cheney prepare to leave the White House. First, Lionel Beener. His October 27th piece in The Guardian is titled Striking Out in Syria. Then journalist Dar Jamail joins us to talk about Iraq, how the war is inextricably tied to the global economic crisis and how changes in U.S. military policies are leading to an escalation. Lionel Beener, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You've been critical of Bush's recent policies using airstrikes to target those he's calling terrorists in Syria and Pakistan. Just go over what you found wrong with this new counterterror strategy.
See, I think it shows that we don't know how to deal with this. We're in uncharted territory, and we don't know what we're doing. My argument has been, and I argue this in my Guardian article, that the conventional wisdom is that time is on the side of the terrorist organizations, who are thinking in years, decades, even more so in the future. They're not in a hurry. They're not voted into office the way our governments are. Our governments have to have body bags, or we have to be showing results in terms of making progress in the war on terror to show, listen, you know, look at what we've done, the surge. Everything has been sort of a benchmark we meet that we can say, listen, we're winning. Terrorist groups don't have to worry about that. But I would actually flip that sort of logic on its head. I actually think time favors the government, and I'll tell you why. Because if you give the terrorists enough rope, I think they will hang themselves. And I think that is sort of what we're seeing in Anbar province. When Al-Qaeda in Iraq came in and really started to not just target coalition forces, but target Sunnis, locals. I mean, the local people were actually the people who were dying. And that turned the locals against them. I think we could see the same thing in Pakistan and parts of Afghanistan. Most people will disagree with me, I think, on that. They'll say, no, it's different. You can't, it's apples and oranges. However, I think if you give terrorists, and we saw this too with the Kurds, the PKK, we've seen this with the FARC, we've seen this with a lot of terrorist groups. If you give them enough time, they'll actually shoot themselves in the foot. And so time, in some ways, will actually favor the state, so long as the state does not respond with disproportionate force. And that brings up the issues of proportionality, but also the tendency of states to over-respond is great. And we saw that with Israel in 2006 in July when Hezbollah crossed in and kidnapped some of its soldiers. The Israelis were accused of using disproportionate force. Now, the argument could be made that Israel was responding into self-defense. Well, the argument of self-defense is what we're using right now in terms of in Iraq and why we're going into Syria. My argument is that we tend to always respond with disproportionate force. And what happens then is you have special force raids and all these things, which kills a lot of civilians. It looks terrible on the newspapers in the Arab world. And it really turns the locals against us. We have the worst PR when we do this. But we'll get like the next Zarqawi or somebody. We're not going to get, I don't think we're going to get Bin Laden this way. And so we have these kind of small tactical victories, but at the expense we're losing the war, I think, in the long run. I'm saying we should work on with our allies. There's extradition treaties. We can do a lot more to sort of provide more social, economic, and other benefits, do some of the things that some of these groups are doing on the local level, which we don't do a good job of. By providing goods and, you know, services, especially in like places like Southeast Turkey, where you saw as they started doing better economically, their support for the PKK waned because the opportunity cost of siding with one versus the government wasn't very high. And that's the same thing in Lebanon, which is why Hezbollah is so popular among average Lebanese. So the important thing we should be doing then is not bombing them. And I just don't think you can bomb terrorists and win that way. I just think it's a policy that just looks like they're trying to grab at straws right at this point because they have a few months left of the administration. What scares me, though, going forward is that Obama has said essentially, assuming he's our next president, he's essentially said that he will continue this policy. He's the one who first articulated the policy in Pakistan.
I want to play a clip now of Dr. Tariq Amin Khan of Toronto's Ryerson University. He's being interviewed on The Real News, therealnews.com, about support from the Pakistani government for the Lashkar, or LT. The U.S. State Department lists the Lashkar as a terrorist group, but they're being supported in Pakistan because they're willing to fight the Taliban, and Pakistan has been militarily weakened during the past year.
You know, wherever these Maliks or these Lashkars are strong, they will be able to drive back the Taliban. But the Taliban will move to another area where they have strength. So, for instance, there are other areas within the Northwest where, for instance, those tribal heads are really leaders of the Taliban. So, you know, they will gravitate there, and it'll be more difficult for the government to remove them from those areas. Also, they could move into the interior of the country. That is, they could go into the urban centers and cause more havoc there. So I really think this is not the way to deal with the problem. It's only going to magnify it. What they need to really do is to look at the social structures in that part of the country, which are really very depressed. People don't really have the means of livelihood. There is really no industry. There's no education. You know, those are the basic needs that people need to be met, which the government is not doing anything about.
He draws an analogy between the Lashkar and the Afghan Mujahideen, which the U.S. supported during the 1980s during the Afghan war against the Soviet Union.
I really think they're playing with fire. Given that you arm a people and you arm them at a point where they have all the sophisticated weaponry at their disposal, you know, that could be used in any way. Once, let's supposing the Taliban are done away with, what do you think that those guys are just going to surrender their arms? They're not. And I think that's where things can go. Because, you know, this similar thing has happened 20 years ago when the Mujahideen were armed by both the U.S. and Pakistan. And look what that has turned into. That they are the ones who've now become the Taliban. So what happens when these people, the Lashkars, the problem gets resolved, let's just say, and the military moves back, the people are still armed, and then that can be used in a whole other different direction.
Lionel Boehner, Tariq Amin Khan seems to be saying something similar to what you've said about helping civilians, winning hearts and minds. Now, he mentioned specifically the Mujahideen, armed through Pakistan's Zia during the 1980s by George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush's father.
I think you've touched on the exact essence that we're struggling with in our counterterrorism problem, is that yesterday's enemies are today's friends. And we saw that in Anbar province with the Sunni awakening and some of the tribal sheikhs that we had to start arming and actually bribing with money because they were taking on al-Qaeda in Iraq. And you also mentioned the word blowback. And I think blowback is really important for your listeners, because part of what's happening in Syria, as well as Pakistan, is sort of blowback. We're seeing it. The foreign jihadis who became radicalized, they cut their teeth in Iraq, and now they're leaving. They're going across the Syrian border, but they're also going to other theaters of war, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and they are becoming radicalized. I mean, a lot of the terrorists cut their teeth against the Soviets back in Afghanistan, or in Chechnya against the Russians back sort of in the 90s. So we're seeing this kind of blowback happening. I can't speak specifically to some of the groups you mentioned, but I can speak to what I've heard recently, and which is, should the U.S. negotiate with the Taliban and certain elements of the Taliban who are moderate? And, you know, this comes up every once in a while with how do you negotiate with terrorists, because we're sort of not allowed to under our own laws, and we have a lot of restrictions on that. However, we are negotiating and working with our former Fedayeen and different Sunni Islamic groups in Iraq, and it's shown success. I mean, it's part of the surge. You can't say you can replicate that directly in Pakistan. There are different elements. You can't have a surge, or you can't necessarily say, well, it worked in Iraq, and so therefore we can do it in Pakistan. The territory there is very unnavigable. It's very hard to really go in, and we're not even sure who to deal with. I mean, there's just different Taliban people on the Pakistan side as well as the Afghan side. We're not sure exactly where, if we were going to negotiate, it would be with. There's a lot of trouble right now. The biggest problem we're seeing more and more in that theater is really the Afghan government. If you look at the drug money, it's going a lot towards the Afghan government. But the U.S. now going out and just taking the fight, the problem with what we're doing now is it seems like a little bit too late. It just won't have the effect we're trying to. And plus, it coming this close to the election. So I really do think we're starting to realize that the last couple of years along the Afghan-Pakistan border, we've had no policy. We've been basically propping up Musharraf. We've basically been propping up the government in Kabul, and we've gotten no results. And so now the idea is we can go into Pakistan now because we don't have Musharraf now in charge. And we have sort of a Security Council resolution that was passed after the events of 9/11 that allow us to kind of violate state sovereignty in the sense that if you're harboring terrorists, which Pakistan is doing, we can kind of go in and take matters into our own hands. And I think that's what we're doing. The problem with that, though, is we're obviously killing a lot of civilians, and we're having very much, I think there's going to be a blowback in the sense that we're going to turn Pakistani and Afghan public opinion even more against us in the process. The nature of war, in my opinion, is changing. We're not seeing, when you're in Istanbul, you have no idea that there's a war going on between Turkey and Iraq on the southeastern front. It's very limited. It's very much cross-border. It's in and out raids. It's cat and mouse, hot pursuit kind of things. It's special forces. It's none of these things are really long or protracted conflicts. We're seeing more frequent raids, and that has a consequence. I mean, it's sort of this, I think, new nature of war, and I don't see it. I think I use the Goldilocks analogy. It's just heavy-handed enough to kind of kill civilians and have that devastating PR, which is, I think, what we're trying to achieve, is really get the populations behind us. But it's just weak enough to not actually get rid of the threat that we have. So you have a worst of both worlds scenario, where you're sort of poking at these terrorists, but you're not actually eradicating them, and you can't eradicate them. I mean, the military solutions just don't work, so you have to then go to the political, or you have to work with your allies in places like Syria. I mean, I don't see why we didn't just keep working with them, unless they're, you know, there's all sorts of theories out there why maybe Damascus, you know, actually knew about it. I mean, well, who knows? But my point is that these kinds of hot pursuit raids don't work.
Lionel Boehner has written about the Mideast for the Council on Foreign Relations and various U.S. and foreign publications. We turn next to Dar Jamail, who covered the Iraq War for 8 months during 2003 and 2004. His award-winning book on the war is titled Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Dar Jamail joins us from on the road, where he's working with a team of journalists, authors, activists, and military veterans of the Iraq War and occupation. In his perspectives piece in Truthout, truthout.org, Dar writes that the team is embarking on a countrywide tour, talking about the occupation of Iraq and the American Empire in the hope that the American public might consider resisting both. Dar Jamail, welcome.
Thanks, Dory. Good to be with you again.
Dar, the U.S. is trying to negotiate a way to remain in Iraq for three more years, and there is increased training of Iraqis by the U.S. military, including now U.S. training of Iraqis on how to fly U.S. military aircraft. Just comment on these not-so-subtle changes in U.S. military policy that could lead to escalation in the region.
The U.S. definitely caused itself a very complex situation in Iraq in trying to negotiate this status of forces agreement. Status of forces agreements are what's required for U.S. military bases and installations to exist on foreign soil around the globe. So there's different types of SOFA agreements. According to the Council of Foreign Relations, there's over 100 different SOFA agreements around the world for U.S. bases. They range anywhere from maybe a few months up to several years. They have to be renegotiated on a regular basis, where the U.S. government pays the host country to allow them to have bases there. And that's basically what is being negotiated or attempted to be negotiated in Iraq. And the U.S. is in a situation now where, ironically, the puppet government that they helped create and support in Baghdad, primarily by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, is actually standing up to them and saying, now, no, we want to negotiate this, but that means you will be 100% out of this country by the end of 2011. We will have jurisdiction over the military when it's here to a certain degree. We will not grant soldiers immunity for crimes they commit, and other very contentious points that they are now demanding. So it's going to be interesting to see how the U.S. negotiates this, because, of course, the world is watching. I am in the camp that believes they never have any intention of withdrawing all of their U.S. military from Iraq. And if we look at the national security strategy coupled with the physical evidence on the ground, I think there's ample evidence to support that claim. But they are still, at the same time, doing things, as you mentioned, of training pilots, trying to stand up an Iraqi force that will be loyal and dependent on the U.S. to survive. And another thing that happened recently, just last month, the Iraqi so-called government approved a purchase of 36 F-16 U.S. high-tech fighter jets. This is while their infrastructure is in total shambles, literally people starving in the streets. But miraculously, the Iraqi government finds enough money to make a giant weapons purchase from the U.S. So that shows you about how much autonomy this so-called government actually has from the United States.
Dar, Syria has asked the U.N. Security Council to take action against the U.S. over a helicopter raid Sunday, October 26th. Now, U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has just issued what sounds like a warning that U.S. policy in the so-called War on Terror continues, and that the U.S. will now hold state terror groups and non-state actors and individuals accountable. How do you think this applies in context with the U.S. raid in Syria, and how will it be received by various Iraqi groups?
Basically, across the board, it's been condemned. I have not seen one group in Iraq that has supported this, aside from a few odd politicians who are basically direct puppets of the U.S. Empire project via the Bush administration. I mean, this is basically imperial hubris. The U.S. is sending a very clear message. Look, we're going to do what we want, when we want, and if you're not going to come to our terms while we try to negotiate this status of forces agreement, we're going to just go do an airstrike on one of your neighbors. It's going to violate international law. There's nothing you can do to stop us. And also uses to try to kind of pose this operation as, we're doing this in your security. Look, we took out an al-Qaeda leader. Of course, there's no hard evidence to support this claim. It's all based on simply U.S. military spokespeople's information. We have video evidence that completely contradicts that there was any fighters killed in this attack. What we have is video evidence of simply civilians and several children being killed, and then footage of their funerals, footage of people rushing to the scene to see what happened and help them. It really is simply, as I said, imperial hubris, where this is the Bush doctrine. That strike occurred. Gates comes out less than 48 hours later and backs it up and says, we will basically go to any length necessary to continue this project. And that's what's being done. And at the end of the day, the Iraqi government, with extremely limited sovereignty, I mean, if your country's occupied, the government of your country there, do the math. It's not going to have much, if any, sovereignty at all. That's the position that they're in. Most people in the Iraqi government have condemned this action, along with basically everyone excepting Israel around the Middle East coming out and condemning it as a violation of international law and an act of terrorism, which is exactly what it is.
You have been working on a book about U.S.-Iraq war veterans. Just go over some of what you're saying publicly about the cost of the Iraq war.
Yes, I actually have just finished a manuscript on my second book, which is about resistance being born within the U.S. military against the occupation. Already what we're seeing, and this started early on in the occupation, and it is consistently increasing over time, we have resistance in Iraq. We have soldiers refusing to do missions. We have had mutinies. We have had fragging. We are having soldiers go out on fake missions in order to safeguard their lives rather than going out and actually patrolling the hot areas. And according to the Pentagon, 45,000 troops have gone AWOL since this war was launched. That number is increasing every single month. We have accelerating rates of suicide. We're right now, according to the Army, on track to have another record year of suicides committed by soldiers who are in Iraq. And all this is happening because it's clear now to everyone, and actually the majority of the people in the military, that this was a war based on lies. This occupation is continuing indefinitely. There is no end in sight. People are upset. This is compounded by the fact that when soldiers come back home to the United States, the VA is in a state of a collapse. We have 1,000 soldiers a month that are technically under VA care that are trying to commit suicide. We have 18 soldiers a day, veterans from all wars, 18 a day committing suicide in this country alone. We have a situation where soldiers come home, they have to wait an average of 6 months just to get their initial appointment within the VA. So when you hear that information as context, it's very, very clear that this is a government that does not care about soldiers in the military. They are not concerned with making sure, going to what lengths are necessary to ensure that these soldiers get the care they need when they come home. This is not lost to most people in the military. This, coupled with this bogus so-called mission in Iraq, have really come together to kind of form a perfect storm where we now have resistance in the military, and it is growing. And there are groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War that are doing things like opening veterans' houses around the country, opening GI coffee houses. They do have a GI resistance newsletter called the Sit Rep that they're distributing on bases. Their ranks are growing, and the structure is being laid down in place to support a GI resistance movement that will only grow over time because there is no end in sight to both these occupations.
Dar, we've seen very sad stories, one on Democracy Now! Of a woman who lost her son and then was losing her home, one of these horrible bank deals of foreclosure. A private individual bought her home at an auction and then gave it back to her so she and her family could move back in. What about this idea that Americans, after the 2008 presidential vote, can organize to bring the war to an end so that they can save their economy?
Absolutely. I think that's a good example. We have one crisis after another happening with how this war is affecting this country so deeply. And I'm glad that this type of information is coming to light because so many people in this country don't think this war has a direct bearing on them. And the reality, it does, obviously, in the most obvious way with people that have loved ones serving overseas. Meanwhile, the economy is going down the toilet. They can't afford to pay their mortgages. They're being kicked out of their houses. And other people are seeing this and are becoming appropriately outraged and activated and stepping in to do something about it.
Dar Jamail is author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. He's currently working on his second book about U.S.-Iraq War veterans. You can find him online at darjamailiraq.com. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.